kiss his full mouth. Karen was also looking at him with longing. The difference was, he was returning her look of lust. Harry. What was his story? Everybody had a story. The music was pumping some dance tune that pulsated in my ears. I knocked into Harry, on purpose, so that his drink spilled. I'm so sorry, I said, taking his glass as he looked with dismay at the sticky liquid dribbling down his thigh. I'll get you another. Karen was chatting to Emma, and hardly noticed me hurry to the bar. It was easy to slip the drugs into Harry's drink with nobody around to see. When I returned, Harry smiled at me and took the drink gratefully. Cheers, Beth. You didn't have to do that. It was my fault, I said, staying by his side. Somebody turned the music up, and a new crowd surged onto the beach. Karen and I got separated, so that I was left alone with Harry. I saw him glance about, trying to spot Karen, but I grabbed his hand, moved us further into the crowd. He was still holding his glass, but I was pleased to note that he'd downed most of it. Dance with me, I said, in my most sensuous voice, moving my body suggestively to the music. He began swaying, half-heartedly, as the crowd enveloped us so that we were in our own little bubble. His pupils were huge in his face. This was my chance, I thought. This was my chance to show her. I just hoped she was watching. I reached up and pulled him closer, grinding myself against him. I saw the surprise in his eyes, but he placed a hand on one of my hips, and I reached up and planted a lingering kiss on his mouth, my hands finding that lovely blonde hair at the nape of his neck, taking in the smell of him, like lemons. I felt him stiffen at first, shocked at my forwardness, but then he went with it, relaxing into the kiss, his tongue finding mine, lost in the moment like I knew he would be. It went on for ages, his hips grinding against mine as he grabbed my ass, pulling me so close that I was almost sitting on him. His drink spilled down the back of a top, but I didn't care. I ground into him, feeling him hard and against me. I was good at seduction. Sean always said so. Eventually, as though waking from a trance, Harry pulled away from me, his eyes widening in horror as it dawned on him what he'd just done. Oh my God, I'm so drunk, he said, as if that made everything all right. I could see his head swiveling around like a meerkat as he tried to spot Karen in the crowd. I need to take a piss, he added, before staggering off. When I turned around, I caught Karen's eye, and by the hurt that flickered on her face, I knew that she had seen everything. The next morning, the two of us travelled to Bangkok alone. I pleaded ignorance, of course. Said it was all him. That he was a sleaze, just like Dylan. She was so angry she never even said goodbye to him, and we left before he got up. I admired her for that. She was stronger than she first appeared, although I noticed that she packed the butter he'd given her. Maybe I should have realized how much she loved him. I can see that now, in hindsight. I can see that I made a terrible mistake in what I did. But I was young and hot-headed, resentful. I'd wanted to punish her for being the one that Harry had chosen. How was I to know that she would end up punishing me? 27. Things had changed between us. On the train back to Bangkok, I sensed her taking sneaky peeks at me from behind a book. Some soppy rom-com, as though trying to figure me out. But she had by measure, surely. She knew what she was letting herself in for when she first heard me hurling the C-word at those guys, when she agreed to swap seats, when she got a tattoo to show me she wasn't a coward. She wanted to impress me, to please me. She must have known I liked Harry too, but she hadn't wanted me to have him. Oh no, she could be selfish when it suited her. It was the end of August by now, and rain drummed on the roof of the train. We didn't speak much as we sat opposite each other. So different to how it had been 3 months previously. No excitable laughter or getting to know each other chatter. No drinking cans of lager or banter. Karen read a book with a sullen look on her face, and I stared out of the window, following the raindrops with my eyes as they snaked down the glass. When it was time for bed, we made up our bunks wordlessly. Karen climbed to the top, and I didn't see or hear from her again until the morning. I would miss Harry too. I wanted to tell her. But it was for the best. If I couldn't have him, then she couldn't either. I lay there in the dark, the occasional light flashing past, and the low hum of conversation from the other passengers keeping me awake. By the time we reached Bangkok, she'd begun to bore me with her sulky silences. I started to think I was going to have to cut her loose. I didn't sense her admiration anymore, just her disapproval. It reminded me too much of Sean. We trudged around the city for most of the day, visiting the Grand Palace and the Reclining Buddha, even though we'd both seen them before. We were aimless, really, engrossed in our own little worlds. Missing Harry and the others, but not wanting to admit it to each other. The sky was overcast by the afternoon, the weather humid. We took a boat down the river to see the houses built on stilts. I was amazed as the fish jumped up, mouths gaping open for the food the guide threw at them, before disappearing back into the murky water. Karen sat staring in the distance, her eyes full of sadness, ignoring everything around her. Karen answered my questions in a monotone as we stepped off the boat, pretending to be engrossed in the architecture. I wanted to tell her to get over it, that it was just a guy, but I acted like there was nothing wrong between us as I studied my guidebook. This hostel sounds cheap, I said, as we veered down a dusty residential side road in a less salubrious part of town. If they've got a space, shall we stay here tonight and then we can travel north tomorrow? She lifted her shoulders. In a half-hearted shrug. Sure. She glanced up at the building. It was narrow and set back between two shop fronts, with large glass windows and a bonsai tree wilting by the entrance. She shadowed me through the hallway and stood, examining the mosaic tiled floor while I inquired about rooms. We are not busy tonight, said an attractive Thai woman with a beaming smile. She had glossy dark hair swept up in a bun, and coral lipstick that didn't look quite right on her face. She led us up two floors, and down a corridor to a narrow room with two sets of bunk beds. A fly buzzed at the open window between the bunks. There was no air conditioning. The room felt muggy and the walls seemed to tilt inwards. I said we'd take it. Karen collapsed onto one of the lower bunks. She had dark rings around her eyes and her face was pale. She curled up on top of the sheets, still fully clothed, her knees tucked into her chest. I told her I was popping out to the 7-Eleven on the corner, promising to be right back. When I returned, armed with bags of crisps and cans of fizzy drinks, she was sitting up, staring into the distance, hugging her knees, a look I couldn't quite read on her face. I offered her a can, and she took it without a word. It hissed and bubbled as she opened it. I went to the loo, and when I came back she was fast asleep, her eyes fluttering behind her lids, the Coke can by the side of the bed opened yet untouched. I picked it up and drank it, not wanting it to go to waste, and settled down on the bottom of the bunk opposite. On the windowsill between our beds sat her Buddha. On impulse I picked it up and shoved it into my backpack. She had to stop looking at him, mooning over Harry. I was doing her a favour. I must have fallen asleep too, because when I opened my eyes I was sprawled out on the bed, still fully dressed. I'd been sleeping heavily and felt groggy, wondering what had woken me. It was so dark, it was as if my eyes were still closed and there was a funny smell in the air, thick and cloying. I could hear shrieks coming from the corridor and the pounding of feet. I sat, bolt upright, hitting my head on the bunk above and blinking as my eyes adjusted to the darkness. My whole body felt lethargic. Somebody was hammering on the bedroom door, as though trying to break in. What was going on? Then the door burst open, smoke filling my room, curling around the bedposts, thick and black, stinging my eyes and making me cough. A fireman was standing in the doorway. He shouted to me in Thai. I tried to get up, but my legs felt heavy and gave way so that I fell to the floor. Karen! I called. Karen, get up! The smoke was so dense that I couldn't tell if she was out of bed or still asleep. I tried to get to my knees, the smoke jamming the back of my throat, threatening to choke me. I couldn't breathe. I was losing the edges of my vision. Suddenly, I felt hands grab me and scoop me up. Somebody speaking. A man's voice. Calm. I realized it was the fireman. He was carrying me down the corridor. My lungs were working overtime as I tried to inhale, but there was no air, just the acrid smoke, like a thick duvet rammed down my throat. I was suffocating. And then we were heading towards an opening, a rectangle of black sky just visible through the smoke. And finally, I was taking deep, desperate breaths of fresh air. The fireman clattered down a metal stairwell, with me slung over his shoulder. A group of teenagers were standing on the ground, gawping in fascinated horror as he dropped me to the pavement. I crumpled onto the hot tarmac and stared as the fire ate away at the top floor of the hostel like some ravenous beast. Karen. Karen was in there. My friend! I pointed in the direction of the hostel. He ran back inside just as one of the windows exploded with a popping sound, glass splintering and raining down on us. There was a cry. The group cowered, covering their heads with their hands while I looked on in dismay. A policeman yelled at us in Thai, then in English. Stand back! It was utter chaos after that. More fire engines turned up, lurid yellow, screaming to a halt outside the hostel. And I was ushered into an ambulance, dazed and still coughing. As the fire worsened, I could only watch, wrapped in a scratchy blanket the colour of horse dung, shivering despite the heat. After a while, I was taken to a hospital, where I was checked for smoke inhalation. When the doctor asked my name, I lied. I didn't want to reveal my real name in case it made the newspapers. You could just imagine the headline. British backpacker survives hostel fire in Thailand. And then Sean would know where I was. I had no documents on me, no details. They would have gone up in smoke along with everything else. I could hardly sleep that night. My chest felt heavy, as though the smoke was still in my lungs. I thought of Karen. Had she managed to escape? The next morning, I was discharged. I had to fill out forms, which I did in a fake name. I went back to the hostel. It was unrecognisable. The top floor completely burnt out, blackened, and seeming to shimmer in the heat. The lower floors covered in ash. Officials were picking their way through the wreckage. My belongings had been destroyed. When I asked if an English girl had been found, a harassed-looking policeman with a notebook shook his head sadly. He took down my details, saying they might want to interview me for the investigation. But I never heard any more from them. Over the next few days, I rang around all the hospitals to find out if she'd been taken in or was having treatment, but each one said the same thing. No Karen Fisher had been admitted. 8 died in the fire that night. 3 members of staff and 5 backpackers. There were 7 survivors and 2 missing. Luckily, the hostel had been relatively empty. Otherwise, there would have been a lot more casualties. There was no mention of my name or Karen's. Most things had been obliterated in the fire. No record survived. Just bodies found. Blackened and burned. I was lost in the days and weeks that followed. Numb going through the motions as I contacted the British Embassy. Applied for a new passport in my maiden name of Elizabeth Davies. A way of escaping Sean permanently. I'm not too proud to admit that I missed Karen. I missed a companionship. Somebody to have a laugh with, even a crap jokes. It's funny how life can change direction so suddenly, as though everything is being engineered by a higher being. My dad was a vicar, and both he and my mum spent their time trying to instill Christ into me, so that even now I can't quite shake the belief that there might be something in it, even though I rebelled against it as a teenager, running away from home at 15 and living in a squat with a group of like-minded people until I met Sean. I told Karen my parents were dead, but the truth was, my mum left. She'd left my dad and she'd left me. I haven't clapped eyes on her since I was 12. She would spend ages sitting on the edge of my bed in the evenings before she ran out on us, spouting words from the Bible at me, telling me that I needed to cleanse myself of sin. I often wondered if she'd done the same after she fucked off with the man from our local church. Or maybe those rules didn't apply to her. My dad blamed me, saying I was difficult, a spoil only child. I wasn't quite right, he said, because I didn't conform to the way he lived his life as a pillar of the community in our quaint chocolate box village. After Mum left, he was always getting called into school because I played truant or got caught smoking behind the bike sheds. When I was seen kissing Theo Masters and the boys lose, my dad had been furious, branding me a slut like your mother. We rowed and I stormed out. I never saw him again. As a kid, I imagined God like a puppet master, hovering above us all, pulling our strings, deciding which way our lives would go as though on a whim. Marrying Sean so young had been an escape. He was desirable because he was older, suave, well off, with his own flat. He had his own construction company. I'd been impressed by him, but I'd jumped from one disaster to another. When Karen had said I was a tough cookie, she hadn't known the half of it. 28. I'd only been back in the country a couple of days, the first time in nearly 10 years, when I saw her photo. I was flicking through a copy of the Mail on Sunday that had been left behind in a cafe, some greasy spoon in Huddersfield. It was a few weeks out of date, middle of March 2017, but I began reading it anyway. It was the name in the caption I recognised, because it was my name, Elizabeth Elliot. What a coincidence, I thought, as I sipped my coffee and reread the story of a teacher who had saved the life of a pupil in a fire. A teacher with the same name as me. Not that I was a teacher. I never did take up my place at the teacher training college. It wasn't what I really wanted to do. I'd stayed on in Thailand for a few years instead. Then I travelled around the world, working in bars and restaurants, always moving on after a few years. Then I met a Spanish man, Mateo, fell in love. We were happy living in Barcelona, until everything went tragically wrong 3 months ago. I'd only returned to England because my dad had died, and only to see if the bastard had left me anything. I was his only child, his next of kin, and I needed money since I'd run from Mateo. It didn't dawn on me at first. It wasn't until I took a closer look at a picture, noticing those large hazel eyes and the smudge on her right arm in a sleeveless blouse, her matching tattoo, almost blurred if you weren't looking for it. Her hair was different, darker now, and cropped, with a sweeping fringe. The same style as mine had once been, as it was in my old passport photo. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. Karen Fisher. How could it be her when she died in the fire? I peered more closely at her face, at the dimples as she smiled down at the children at her feet. It was a surreal moment. When you spend nearly 10 years thinking that someone has died, and that it was somehow your fault. Well, I went into a kind of shock. I sat there shaking, feeling as though I'd downed too many cups of coffee. A waitress had to come over to check that I was all right. Why was she using my name? What did it all mean? I wanted, needed answers. It wasn't hard to find her address. Amazing how easy it is to find details from a newspaper article. Teacher, independent school, Bath. I took the early morning train to Bath. I'd never been before, but the pretty Georgian buildings and the twee little parks turned me cold. It reminded me of York, of my unhappy childhood. Of course Karen would end up somewhere like this. I couldn't imagine her slumming it in Sheffield or Birmingham or any other urban cosmopolitan city. She wasn't cool enough. She was too vanilla. But the whole journey, her deceit churned in my mind, around and around. She let me believe she was dead. Was she trying to escape me? Maybe she'd been rescued and ended up in hospital. But I had rung around all the hospitals. She'd never been admitted. I waited outside the school that wet day at the end of March, obscured by my umbrella. I recognised her straight away, despite a change of hairstyle. From a distance, she could have passed for me, I suppose, or for what I used to look like. My hair was nearly down to my waist now, my face brown and weathered from spending too long in the sun, so that I looked older than my 29 years. Karen, though, looked fresh-faced and more annoyingly. She looked happy, She had a coat slung over her shoulders, one arm in a sling, and she was holding a polka-dot umbrella. She almost skipped through the school gates. Choruses of, "Goodbye, Mrs. Elliot, have a lovely break," echoing in her wake from pupils and parents alike. I followed her as she made the 10-minute journey home by foot. I saw her enter a basement flat in a wide, busy street, and watched from the pavement above as she kissed a tall, handsome man with blonde hair in their kitchen. My life had turned to tatters, and yet she had everything. I stayed in a little bed and breakfast a few streets away and did some more research on my phone. I found out that she'd taken up my place at Middlesex to do a PGCE. She didn't have a degree of her own, I remembered, so she clearly had to pretend to be me to use mine. My purse, passport, national insurance number, everything had been in my backpack. I thought it had been destroyed by the fire. Yet Karen must have had them all this time. I'd never hated anybody so much in my life as in that moment. The anger was so deep, it swelled and grew so that I felt pregnant with it. The bitch had stolen my life, and I was determined to get it back. 29. I made inquiries at the school, found out that they were on their Easter break. I skulked around outside her flat, but it was always in darkness, although I once noticed the old biddy from upstairs watching me from a bay window. I wondered if they were on holiday, whether my journey had been wasted. Then a stroke of luck. On the Wednesday, I saw a light flickering on in the window below the pavement. It was mid-morning, and rain hung in the air, the sky the colour of the nicotine stains on the ceiling of the squat I'd lived in. I descended the steps, ready to confront her, hoping a bloke would be at work. I knocked on her door, my heart hammering, wondering what I'd do when I saw her, what I would say. I heard footsteps padding down the hallway, a low, deep cough, and I froze. It sounded like a man. I was about to turn around and run back up the stairs when the door was wrenched open. And there, standing in the doorway, was Sean. We stared at each other, our faces mirror images of shock. He looked different, older, more weathered, less groomed. He'd been handsome once, with a charm I hadn't been able to resist, until I'd finally grown up and seen through to the bully he really was. The suits and long wool coats he used to favour were now replaced by jeans and a fleece. His eyes were harder than I remembered, his body stockier and more muscular, as though he'd been pumping steroids. He found his voice first. "Beth?" I nodded, fear cutting into me, wondering why he was in Karen's flat. "What the fuck are you doing here? You're supposed to be in Cornwall," he growled. "Cornwall?" I could barely breathe, let alone speak, and the word came out in a squeak. Before I could react further, he grabbed me by the throat, dragging me into the hallway and slamming me up against the wall, his fingers pressing into my windpipe. He kicked the door shut with his foot. "Yes, Cornwall," he spat. His breath smelled of coffee, and I flinched. What had I ever seen in him? He repulsed me. "Please, I can't breathe," I spluttered. He released the pressure on my throat and grabbed my upper arms instead, his fingers pressing into my flesh. There'd be bruising later. "You're supposed to be in Cornwall," he repeated, his teeth clenched, "with your prick of an husband." "I don't have a husband, except you." He shook me then, so hard that I bit the inside of my mouth. I could feel the iron taste of blood on my tongue. "Don't lie to me, you stupid bitch. What the fuck are you doing here?" "I'm not lying," I yelled. "Please, I don't know what you're talking about. I've come to see Karen Fisher." He stopped shaking me. "Karen Fisher?" "She was a friend I met when I went travelling," I said, trying to wriggle from his grasp, but he gripped my upper arms tightly. "I saw a photo of her in the newspaper." "That was you in all the newspapers," he hissed. "No, it wasn't. I thought she died in Thailand, but she took my identity. She pretended to be me. I don't know why. His eyes flashed. "So you don't live in this flat with Jamie Hall?" "I've never heard of Jamie Hall,"
Then what are you doing here?
I came to confront Karen. He staggered backwards, as though I'd been the one to deliver the blow.
For fuck's sake,
he groaned, putting his hands to his head, stalking up and down the hallway.
For fuck's sake!
I couldn't understand why he was so agitated. What have you done, Sean? What have you done with Karen? He always was a manipulative bastard. I'd been too young to see it then, but in that moment, terror shot through me. Had he hurt Karen? He leapt on me then, grabbing my hair and dragging me into a bedroom.
I've been looking for you for years. 9 fucking years. You stole 10 grand from me. Did you think I was going to let you away with that? And then the photograph. I thought I'd found you. And now you're telling me it wasn't you at all, but some other stupid cow pretending to be you.
Spittle was flying out of his mouth as he shouted, his face so red and angry that his eyes bulged.
I want to kick the shit out of you. You've ruined everything.
His eyes glinted, and I could see right to his rotten core. I always knew that Sean would kill me if he saw me again. I'd betrayed him, tricked him, stolen from him and run off. I knew he'd never forgive that, which is why I'd kept away all those years. He raised his arm, his meaty hand clenched into a ball, and I cowered, protecting my head, awaiting that first blow. It took me back to when we were married, although he was careful then to hit me where the bruises wouldn't be seen. A vibrating buzz emanated from him and he paused, lowering his arm in surprise, taking his mobile from the back pocket of his grubby-looking jeans. They would once have been designer. Had he fallen on hard times? He frowned as a name flashed up on the screen. His mouth twisted into a sinister smile.
Well, he said, glancing at me. Look who's ringing.
I stared at his thick neck and the tattoo on his arm. My name had once been inked on that left bicep, but now I could see it had been turned into an ugly green snake. He positioned himself between me and the door as he talked to him to his mobile in a fake jovial voice, something about a man called Jim trying to spot fossils. Then he cleared his throat.
Listen, I'm glad you called, actually. There's been a change of plan.
He hesitated, shooting a glance in my direction.
My daughter's coming out of hospital earlier than we'd expected. I know, it's great news. So we'll be going back to our place in London tonight, tomorrow at the latest. I'll leave the key with your neighbour, shall I?
What was he talking about? What daughter? And then he smirked again. Whatever he was up to, he was clearly enjoying himself.
Just drop the key back at the petrol station on your way home. Thanks again, Libby.
Libby? Who were you talking to? I asked him, as he slipped the phone back into his pocket. He grinned, looking ghoulish in the half-light.
It seems your friend Karen Fisher is calling herself Libby, not Beth.
Why are you speaking to Karen? What's going on, Sean? He stared at me as if seeing me for the first time.
I don't like to admit it, but I've been had. She looks more like you than you do.
What happened to you? You look like shit. My guts twisted. Even after all these years, his words hit a nerve.
I thought I'd have a bit of fun with you before fucking up your life. But that's gone tits up now, hasn't it?
He emitted a cynical laugh.
You've even messed up that pleasure. Now I'm going to have to think of something else for you.
What had he been planning to do? Knowing Sean, it was obviously something warped. I played for time. He always was arrogant. He'd enjoy filling me in on what he was going to do. Were you going to kill me?
Of course I was going to fucking kill you. Do you think I'd let you get away with making a fool out of me? With stealing my money?
My mouth was dry, but I asked anyway. How? I was following you.
Or someone I thought were you. In Cornwall. Watching her and her weedy husband. I pushed him when they were visiting a lighthouse. Didn't plan to hurt him then, just wanted to freak them out. But she nearly went over the edge of a cliff.
I thought there was something different about you. You walk, you laugh. But it has been 10 years. He shrugged and grinned nastily.
I came back here to steal your bank account details so I could get my 10 grand back. Plus interest. Oh, and I poisoned some of the food in Cornwall. In the fridge. Covered your underwear in animal's blood and buried it in the garden. But I fucked up. Got the wrong person.
My underwear?
That expensive basque I bought you, remember?
I kept it. All these years I knew I'd be seeing you again. That eventually I'd find you. I treated you well.
Took you away from that disgusting squat you were living in. Bought you nice things and this is how you repay me.
Treated me well? Despite my fear, I couldn't keep my mouth closed.
You beat me up. You abused me. You took advantage of me, my age, my vulnerability.
The punch when it came was unexpected and knocked me back against the bed. It felt like my cheekbone was about to explode. I could feel nearly 10 years' worth of pent-up frustration and anger in the force of that fist. Then he straddled me, and I hit out at him. But my blows were as ineffectual as water. He flipped me over so that I was on the front, and grabbed my arms roughly behind my back. I could feel him tying something around them, cutting into my flesh.
"I'll be back for you,"
he said, getting up off the bed. And then he left me there, in the dark, my eye throbbing where he punched me. As soon as I heard him sound the front door, I worked on loosening my ties. I sat up against the wooden headboard and ran my wrists against the sharp edges, gradually sawing away. He'd used some kind of thick tape. Did he carry it around with him? Nothing had surprised me with that psycho. I was sweating as I toiled away and my wrists were rubbed raw, but I eventually managed to cut through the tape. Sean had been too cocky. He'd forgotten that I'd had enough practice at this when we were married. I jumped up, glancing around the bedroom that Karen slept in. Modern and clean, with Scandinavian oak furniture. A dressing table cluttered with different potions and perfume bottles. A photo of her and her husband, sitting proudly amongst the mess. Shauna called him Jamie. Jamie Hall. I needed something hard, heavy. Something to use as a weapon for when he came back. I opened a wardrobe, hoping to find a sharp stiletto heel or a heavy buck to smack him with. But there were only trainers and belly flats. No heels at all. And then I spotted something shoved in the corner of the wardrobe, among some summer clothes and handbags. Something familiar. I leaned in and grabbed it. The stone was cold under my fingers. The Buddha that Harry had given her. Why had she kept it? Did she still yearn for him? The one that got away? I thought we'd be okay, Karen and me. Two strong women escaping our past without the need of a man. But she betrayed me. The thought of teaching Karen a lesson gave me the impetus and the strength I needed. That's the thing about me and Sean. We were more alike than he realised. Perhaps that's what attracted us to each other when we were young. We would have made a great team if we weren't constantly trying to outdo each other with our power struggle to come out on top. Then I thought of Mateo. Kind, loyal Mateo, with his big brown eyes that always looked sleepy. My heart twisted with longing for him. He'd kept the darkness at bay. He'd made me want to be a better person. But he'd seen through me in the end too. The room was drenched in darkness. Where was Sean? I didn't leave the bedroom in case he suddenly came back. I pocketed the Buddha. It was heavy enough to use as a weapon if needed. I didn't want to risk the front door, so I wrenched open the bedroom window and climbed into the garden. The light was dwindling, casting shadows on the overgrown grass. I wondered what was beyond the garden. Would it be easy to escape? Before fear could kick in, I sprinted across the lawn. Then I heard a bellow and turned my head, stumbling in my eagerness to get away. Sean was clambering out of the window. I ran for the bushes, but it was so quick he was soon only an arm's length away. I forced down a shriek of terror and darted behind a large bush, my hand reaching inside my leather jacket for the Buddha. I crouched down, my breathing shallow, my heart beating so ferociously I was worried he'd be able to hear it.
"I know where you are, you stupid bitch,"
he called, sounding amused. He peered around the bush. I screamed and swung the Buddha at him with all my might, smacking him in the temple, relieved and horrified as the ornament made contact with his skull. He staggered, his shocked eyes finding mine as he went crashing backwards like a tree being felled. Fear took hold of me so that, for a few moments, I was rooted to the spot, staring at the dent in his skull and the arc of blood that had sprayed from the back of his head, staining the grass red. Then I knelt down beside him, my knees sinking into the damp lawn, careful not to touch him. I must leave no evidence. I glanced up furtively. The building was over 200 feet away. The windows opaque, some with curtains hanging open, others with blinds rolled up. Was anybody watching? I was already starting to think like a criminal. Was I seen at the bottom of the garden among the weeds and overgrown grass? Was I seen killing my husband? So I was a murderer. It had been surprisingly easy, killing a man. The moment my fingers encircled that ornament, I knew I wanted to do as much damage as possible. I wanted to kill. I felt no guilt, no remorse. And now he was out of the picture. For the first time since I was 16, the threat of him no longer hung over me. He'd taken enough of my life, and I wasn't going to let him take any more. I stayed in Karen's flat that night, too scared to leave. But it spooked me, the thought of Sean's body at the bottom of a garden. How long before it was discovered? I was terrified that someone, maybe that old crone upstairs, had seen me. I snooped around, of course, saw that everything was in my name. My bank details, a credit card, a driving license. There was nothing that betrayed who she really was. So she had been lying to that husband of hers. I was shocked by how effortlessly Karen had stepped into life as Elizabeth Elliot. Clever to use Libby instead of Beth. Maybe she felt that sounded posh, more in keeping with a new middle-class life. Perhaps she felt she could disassociate herself from what she'd done if she used a different name. How would she survive the fire? I couldn't understand it. I was the last person to be rescued from the hostel, and I'd been lucky. Nobody had been rescued after me, that's what the fireman said. So how could Karen Fisher be here, pretending to be me? Unless she wasn't in the hostel that night. Unless she'd already left. 100 questions filled my head as I pocketed her bank statements. It'd be easy to access her money. She was complacent enough to have a 4-digit number scribbled on a piece of paper in the filing cabinet. A PIN. She was obviously using my national insurance number. She really must have thought I was dead, to do something so audacious. And then it hit me, so hard that I had to sit down on a sofa. I thought I'd been the one in control. But she had been more cunning, more daring than I'd ever given her credit for. I spent ages washing the Buddha, making sure to wipe away any traces of my fingerprints from its surfaces, its creases and dents. My stomach turned at the sight of Sean's blood. Then I put it on a sideboard where she'd be able to see it. All this fuss, I thought. All this fuss about Harry, and she'd hidden the Buddha away as though it meant nothing. I prowled around her flat, examining the photos of her and Jamie at various events or holidays. They looked happy together, usually joined by a big dopey-looking dog. I was relieved to see there was no evidence of children. Oh, Karen. She had no clue that I was already married, and that when she tied the knot under my name with a precious Jamie, she was committing bigamy. A bigamist. It tickled me to think that. Her one mistake. And when Sean's body was found, as it inevitably would be, Karen would get the blame. And then the whole sorry tale would come out. What would Jamie think when he found out the truth about his not-so-perfect wife? All I needed to do for now was stand back and watch as her whole world imploded. 30. I took a perverse enjoyment out of spying on them when they returned from Cornwall. Their disintegration as they realised that someone had stolen their credit cards and emptied their bank accounts. Their paranoia as they wondered who was behind it all. Their fear eating away at their relationship. I opened an account at a catalogue company in my name and sent Karen items to jog her memory of our time in Thailand. A wig, the colour and style that her hair used to be. A backpack, similar to the one we both carried. And then there was the old biddy who lived upstairs. A few times she spotted me hanging around while Karen, Libby, was at work in the job that should have been mine. Karen never saw me, though. She was too engrossed in her own smug little world. I don't know what my plan was exactly. All I could think about was that Karen must have left me behind in that hostel, and she needed to pay. One afternoon,
I was hovering in the alleyway between her building and next door.
I was waiting for Karen to get home from work when I heard a tap on the bay window, and the old lady's face peered over her net curtains, beckoning me in. I was intrigued, and a little afraid. It started to rain, and so I was getting impatient and cold in my thin jacket, so I made my way tentatively to her front door. She opened it only partially, as though she was scared of me. It made me wonder what she'd seen from her window. Had she seen me killing Sean? I dismissed this idea at once. If she had seen me, then she wouldn't be inviting me into her home, would she?
"Are you looking for someone, love?" she said, not unkindly. "I've seen you before. Can I help you with anything?"
Nosy old bat. The lie slipped easily off my tongue.
"I'm Libby's sister," I said, smiling politely. "But we've sort of lost touch. I don't know whether I'd be welcome."
I shrugged, averting my eyes shyly and shuffling my feet, staring down at her Victorian floor tiles. She'd opened the door then, as I knew she would, and invited me inside. My hands were so cold that they burned with chilblains in the too warm house. She fussed around, making a cup of tea while I stood in her large sitting room, gazing around in wonder. It was cosy, with knick-knacks covering every surface, and gilt-edged plates on the wall. Old-fashioned, but homely. The sort of place I would have loved to have grown up in, instead of the sparsely furnished vicarage with pictures of Christ above the beds. My eyes went to the array of photographs on the mantelpiece, all showing her in another life, various stages of being young, happy and in love. She'd been pretty once. The black and white photos reminded me of actresses from old films with her pin curls and her dark lips. An old-fashioned radio sat on a shelf, the male presenter talking in dulcet tones. I found his voice soothing. She noticed me, looking, and turned it down with a self-conscious smile.
"I always have it too loud, but it's company."
I found myself nodding. I wondered if she was lonely, like me.
"I'm Evelyn," she said. "Please take a seat."
She indicated the chair by the window. She had a tea tray on the side table next to her, with a teapot and two china cups. Was she expecting someone? She offered me tea, and I nodded, blindsided, while she poured and then handed me a cup. As I sat there, numb and unsure as to what I was hoping to achieve, she reached over and took my hand, her eyes going to the bruise on my cheekbone.
"Libby's never mentioned a sister," she said.
"Oh, a family rift, a long time ago." "Has she told you much about her family?" She shook her head.
"No, not really. She said once her mum had died. Libby is very private. But she's a lovely woman. She would welcome you. I knew she would. Don't be afraid, my dear."
I felt a punch of jealousy to my gut. A lovely woman? Hardly. This Evelyn was like a grandmother. And by the way she spoke about Libby, her eyes shining with pride, I realised how much she must care for her. All I wanted, all I had ever wanted, was for someone to care about me in that way. Maybe my mother had once upon a time, before unhappiness had seeped into her, changing her, making her bitter. And my father had always been hard. He loved God, but not much else. I had never known a happy home with laughter and love. I imagined Evelyn would have made a good mother, a good grandmother. The fight began to abate as I sat there, and I realised I was afraid. I thought of my depressing hotel room, with its single bed. How alone I felt. Nothing but a few belongings to show for my 30 years of life. I yearned in that moment for my baby. For Mateo. She leaned forward, her eyes kind.
"What happened?"
And I found myself telling her. About escaping a violent man, falling in love for the first time, having a baby.
and how they were both taken away from me in the cruelest of ways. And now I was left with nothing, while Libby had everything. Everything that should have, could have been mine. Her pale blue eyes smarted with tears, and she gripped my hands in her knotted ones. "Oh, my love," she said, and her face was so full of sympathy and kindness that I felt tears prick my eyes too. "And Libby knows nothing about this. We, fell out before then. When we were young, over a boy, a silly argument." I shrugged. "You know how these things can escalate." She sat back in a chair and picked up a knitting. I watched mesmerized as the needles flew back and forth, the soft lemon wool dangling onto her lap in a ball. And then I noticed what she was knitting. Tiny little booties. "Is somebody having a baby?" I said, thinking of my own stillborn baby. The pain in Mateo's eyes as realization dawned that we wouldn't be playing happy families after all. My dad's voice in my ear, telling me this was God's punishment for being wicked. Her eyes lit up. "They're for Libby." "Libby." The words stuck in my throat, and I placed the cup and saucer down on the side table with a shaky hand. She nodded. "She hasn't told me officially, but I know." She smiled enigmatically. "I can tell when a woman is pregnant. I was a midwife, you know, a long time ago." She gave a girlish giggle, but my whole body was rigid with shock, fury inching its way through my veins. "She must have noticed," and she added hurriedly. "Oh, my love, I'm so sorry. That was insensitive of me after your loss." I stood up, hurriedly, knocking the side table over in my haste. My teacup clattered to the ground, sending cold tea down the legs of the table and puddling onto the wood flooring. Evelyn dropped a knitting at her feet, the wool unraveling. "Oh, my love, it's a shock. I'm sorry. I need to go. I can't do this." I stumbled away, blinded by tears. It wasn't fair. Karen didn't deserve any of this. She had everything I wanted. Just as I was about to leave the room, I heard a groan. I turned back to see Evelyn clutching her heart, her face a strange colour like putty. "Evelyn! Evelyn!" I ran over to her, but she slumped forward, a gurgle coming from her lips. I gently lifted her head, but her eyes were already lifeless, just like Sean's. A cold feeling crept into my heart, and I slumped forward, next to her chair. The only person in months to show me kindness was dead. I sat with her until it grew dark, then sneaked out of her flat by the back door. My dad had been right about me. I was bad, through and through. I had the devil in me. I destroyed everything I touched. Part 3. Bath. 31. Hartley's expression is smug as he slaps a photograph on the table in front of me. It's a black and white print of the man from Lizard Point, but taken years ago, when his face was less ravaged and he'd looked attractive. So this was Sean Elliott. Beth's ex. In all the time we were travelling together, she never once mentioned that she was married to him, or even what he was called. She'd drip-fed me information about him so that I was aware he was abusive, and that he put her in hospital, but that was all. I could understand why she'd never said more about him. Thailand had been her escape as it had been mine, a place where our past hadn't mattered. Or so I thought. Beth. I tried not to think about her over the years because to do so would cause my stomach to flip with guilt. When I first met Beth, I really liked her. I thought she was sparky and I admired her courage. When she said she had a place at teacher training college, I have to admit it shocked me. I couldn't see her as a teacher. She seemed so tough and streetwise, with a hard face and a foul tongue. But it was obvious she had a bit of a chip on her shoulder. She didn't take any shit, and I'd felt safe travelling with her. She could be manipulative. I cottoned on to that quite early on. But then the business with Harry, and what came afterwards, made me realise that she was actually a nasty piece of work. What had her husband been doing in my flat?
He was obviously the one who'd arranged the house swap. D.S. Burns said he was a builder, working on the hideaway, so he would have had access to keys and must have cut one for himself.
But why go to all that trouble?
Do you recognise this man?
Asked Hartley, in an impatient tone, bringing him back to the present. Another detective, a woman this time, sits next to him. She's young, in her early 30s, and has very straight, glossy blonde hair in a bob. She doesn't speak. I shake my head, tears springing to my eyes, mumbling. No comment. Like my duty solicitor advised me to do. He sits next to me, reassuring in his suit, his briefcase open on the table. I am in too deep. I took Beth's identity, without a thought for her past or the future repercussions it would cause. How can I ever tell them the truth without losing everything? My life as Karen Fisher had been bleak. When my mum died, I was left with my dad, a raging alcoholic. He never hit us, he wasn't a violent drunk. Alcohol just heightened his emotions. And I believe he really did love my mum, in his own way. They rowed, usually about his drinking, and once an affair with the local barmaid. But when he was sober, and he could be, for long stretches at a time before relapsing again, he was the loveliest man in the world. He'd surprise her with flowers or trips to Scarborough or Whitby. She loved it by the sea. He made her laugh, and would sneak up on her while she was chopping vegetables in the kitchen, snake his arms around her waist, nuzzling her neck. She would bat him away with it. Get off, you silly bugger. But I could tell by the way her eyes lit up that she enjoyed it. They never had much money, and my dad was forever in and out of jobs due to his drinking. We lived in a small village in a two-up, two-down. It wasn't much, but Mum kept it clean and tidy, and it was furnished with little knick-knacks and cushions that she'd made. That's why I'd always loved being at Evelyn's place. Its warmth and clutter reminded me of home. But then my mum died and everything changed. My dad was desperate without her. He'd go out most evenings, drinking, rolling in late and collapsing onto the sofa. A big, heavy mass, reeking of alcohol and cigarettes. I tried to keep our home looking nice as my mum had done, but when Dad was on a bender, he'd come in drunk and smash things up. He never threw anything away, so empty cans, fag butts and half-eaten crisp packets would be strewn all over the floor. I was forever clearing up after him. I ended up missing school to nurse him as the drink took its toll on his health. I loved him, and I wanted him to get better. I couldn't bear to lose both my parents. Even though I did well in my GCSEs, especially considering I'd missed so much school, I knew A-levels and university were out of the question. Dad was on benefits, but they didn't stretch very far, and I needed to work. So I left school at 16 and took any job I could find. The pay was terrible, as I wasn't qualified for anything. I had no choice but to watch my friends leave our small village for the big cities and universities like Manchester, Leeds, Bristol and Cardiff, places I could only dream of going to, and I soon lost touch with them all. Then, when I was 20, my dad's liver finally gave out. He was only 53 when he died. I had no other family. My parents hadn't kept in touch with their own families. I sensed there was a rift when they got married, so I'd never known any aunts or uncles or grandparents. The house I'd grown up in was put on the market, but my dad owed so much money in unpaid mortgage fees that I only got a few thousand out of the sale. Not knowing what to do with my life, I decided I needed to get away from the place where everyone knew my sad history. I had nothing, and nobody to keep me in Yorkshire. I'd always been a loner, slinking through life, hoping nobody would notice me or feel sorry for me. I bought the first available flight, which happened to be to Thailand. On the night of the fire, I'd watched, rigid with shock, as flames licked the hostel and gusts of smoke surged out of the windows, knowing that Beth was trapped in there. It was chaos. Fire engines and an ambulance wailed to the scene. Then came shouts from the firemen as they darted in and out of the building, or tried to put out the fire with huge hoses. The air was scorching. Black smoke drifted up my nostrils and down my throat. I felt sick.
Where was Beth? She must still be in bed. She'd been out of it when I left. I grabbed a fireman, screamed at him that my friend was still in there. But he just shook his head, sadly. I staggered away, unable to witness it any longer, and found another hostel to stay in. I couldn't sleep. I just lay there, too horrified to even cry. I returned the next morning. The hostel was a burnt-out shell. I was told that 8 had died. They couldn't tell me if Beth was among them. "Not yet," said a policeman in halting English. "Not until their bodies have been identified." I rang around a few hospitals, asked if an Elizabeth Elliot had been admitted, but nothing. It wasn't until I was ensconced in a hotel room a few streets away, shocked and nauseous, the smell of smoke still strong in my nostrils, that I realized in my hurry to flee the hostel I'd picked up Beth's backpack instead of my own. It had been a snap decision. When I saw everything that was in her bag, her wallet stuffed with cash, her passport and her national insurance card, I thought about using them as a means to keep traveling, rather than having to hang around waiting for the embassy to issue me another passport. I had no doubt that my possessions had been destroyed in the fire. I sat on the bed, my head reeling, wondering what to do. Her stuff laying out in front of me on the orange blanket. And then I saw it. The Buddha that Harry had given me. What was it doing among her things? Then my eye went to the letter. It was from the teacher training college, offering Beth a place on their 1-year PGCE course in English. They'd included all the information about the course and details on placements and funding for the £9,000 fees. How hard could it be? English was my best subject at school. By admitting to university, I hadn't coped with doing a degree. Beth had scribbled on the letter in pen, reminding herself to ring them to defer. Had she done it? I pushed the thought from my mind, telling myself I'd never get away with it. They would have met Beth for an interview. But how long ago? We didn't look dissimilar. And if I cut my hair and dyed it darker, then I could pass for her, couldn't I? They would only have met her once. A passing resemblance, that was all it needed to be. We both came from Yorkshire, so I had similar accents. No. I couldn't do it. I wasn't brave enough. I dismissed the idea and tried to sleep. But a little voice in my head kept probing and prodding, telling me that I had to do it. What were the options otherwise? Go back to university and do a degree myself? But that would take years, and by the end of it, I'd be in so much debt that I'd forever be trying to pay it off. I thought of my parents, of the life they lived. I wanted more. The next day I rang the college and said I was interested in starting in September after all. Then I went to a local salon and had my long hair dyed a rich chocolate brown and chopped into a pixie cut so that I resembled Beth's passport photograph. I liked my new haircut. It showed off my big eyes and accentuated my cheekbones, so as the years went by, I ended up keeping the style. Every now and again, I'd experience bouts of doubt that would make me stop in my tracks, my heart pounding, my mind whirling. What was I thinking? What if I got caught? What if Beth had survived the fire and took the place on the course herself? And then I'd convince myself that she was dead. She had to be. There was no way she could have survived. And if she had, by some miracle, managed to escape, then she would have continued to travel up north. She couldn't leave the country until she had a new passport. She was having doubts about being a teacher, she told me so herself. And the course was only a year. Not long to pretend to be someone else. Now that the idea had formed in my mind, I knew I couldn't dismiss it. I had to go through with it. The prospect of being a teacher, of working with kids, excited me. I'd have a future. Something to look forward to. It was so risky, but at the same time I felt compelled to do it. As if this was my one chance. What was the worst that could happen? I asked myself. If they found out that I wasn't really Elizabeth Elliot, I'd get chucked off the course. But I had to try. I had to find a way to scrape back some semblance of a future because I couldn't afford to continue travelling forever. And then what? What awaited me back